This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
The Victorian AIDS Council Gay Men's Health Centre presents Well, Well, Well on Joy, a show that's all about sex, health and well-being.
Joy, Joy, Joy. Welcome to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9, where every Monday night we talk about sex, sexual health and the well-being of sexually and gender diverse communities. I'm John, your host for the evening. Joining me in the studio tonight is my lovely co-host, the one, the only, Tex. Welcome, Tex.
Thanks, John. That's really gorgeous of you. And we need to thank Outtakes, who are having their first anniversary show, so congratulations, and another one under the belt, guys. On tonight's show, we're going to be talking about a group of people very near and dear to us, but one that's often overlooked, and that is women living with HIV. We'll be joined shortly by Alison, Juliet and Heather from Positive Women, Australia's only community organisation dedicated to the well-being of HIV-positive women.
Yes, excellent. As always, we love it when you, the listener, contribute to our show. So if you have a comment or burning question, we welcome you to share it with us in one of two ways. You can send us an email at onair@joy.org.au or via text message at 0427-JOY949. That's 0427-569-949. And we'll get it right here in the studio.
Indeed we will, and it's always exciting to get a message into the studio.
Joy 94.9.
This is Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9. You're back in the studio with me, John, and with Tex. We have some very special guests in the studio today. We're very happy to welcome them. But first, the topic we'll be discussing. So since HIV first emerged in the 1980s, Australia's response to the virus has been regarded as one of the best in the world. But despite the success, one of the key populations affected by HIV has been, and continues to be, largely overlooked. That is, only 52% of the world's population, women. Women make up a significant proportion of those living with HIV, but are often ignored by the governments and communities when it comes to advocacy, support, and prevention. So, joining us tonight to talk about women and HIV are CEO Alison Bowie, Health Promotion Coordinator Julia Wittich, and Heather Mugwagwa, the Peer Support Coordinator, all of them from Positive Women Victoria. Ladies, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having us, John.
Thanks for having us, John.
Yes, and you'll probably hear that Heather's joining us by phone. Alison and Juliet are in the studio, but all very welcome here.
Alison, perhaps if we can start with you, could you give us and the listener perhaps an overview of Positive Women? For example, what does the organisation do? Who's the target community? What's the history? All those sorts of things.
Sure, sure. So Positive Women is the only organisation, the only community-based organisation that's specifically funded to support and advocate for women living with HIV. We do have a very long history dating back to the mid-1980s when we were first established by two women, Bev Greet and Deborah Gillies. And they founded the organisation really because they felt in this emerging epidemic that was quite scary back in those days and that not a lot was known about. It was actually thought that it didn't affect women, and I still meet people even today who say, but women don't get HIV. So, but women have always been able to contract HIV, and we can talk a bit more about how and why as we go on. But mm-hmm. Bev and Deborah decided that it was important that women had a voice, and they established Positive Women Victoria. We're very lucky as an organisation to have the support of the Victorian Government, the Department of Health and Human Services, who've been funding the organisation since 1992. So we have a lot of support, and in actual fact, I think the support that our government shows to the sector, and particularly women in the sector, is really groundbreaking in this country. They're absolute leaders in the country in the support they show for women.
Now, what does the population of women living with HIV in Australia look like? So who are they? You know, what are the ages? Like, where do they come from? All of that.
Well, I guess I'll jump in for that one. I suppose when we say a national population of women living with HIV, we're looking at a bit over 10%. So I think at last estimate, there's roughly about 25,000 people living with diagnosed HIV in Australia. This equates to probably about 2,900 women. And I suppose the key point for women living with HIV is the demographics are really varied. So women are a particularly diverse group. The average age is probably around 30 to 39. And we'd probably agree with other estimates that it also sort of say around 49 potentially for some women. Our own membership base, there's an average age of about 47. Though we are Victorian based, we do have members from South Australia, New South Wales, Queensland and Tasmania. And so roughly at about 30 to late 40s, women from culturally diverse backgrounds, regional Victoria, urban Victoria, a huge mix. So
And Heather, since we've got you on the line, can you tell us what, and you work directly with the people, so what are the people like in Victoria who you work with? You know, are these women much different from that national profile?
Sorry, can you come again?
Yeah, no problem. I was just asking what, since you're the peer support coordinator, I imagine you do quite a bit of work with the women who live in Victoria, women with HIV. What sort of women are you working with and what sort of activities do you do with them or help them with?
Okay, I work with a lot of women from, I would say, from all over, I wouldn't say all over the world, but it's a diverse group.
Okay.
With women were born in Australia, who are Australians, and we have a huge women that were born overseas, who have migrated Australia, women who originally come from Asia, Pacific region, women from Sub-Saharan Africa. So my role mainly is offering a tailored peer support approach, whereby we just support women one-on-one because we support more than 200 women on our database they're all diverse in terms of their needs. And so what I do is more of a tailored approach, which we find to be working and more responsive for women, as their needs, they're varying, and not one woman is the same as the next woman, though there are certain themes that are the same.
Okay, that seems like an important thing for us to remember. There's not like a single profile that fits everybody who has this experience.
Not at all. And one of the things that is a constant source of surprise is that you think, just when you think you've heard every possible story of discrimination or experience of stigma or unwanted disclosure or you know, health issues, social issues, you'll get a call from a woman and there'll be an issue that you've just never encountered before. So the range of issues that these women experience as a result of being both women and living with HIV is quite astonishing.
I can imagine. How does this compare to, any one of you are welcome to answer this, how does this compare to women who are living internationally, or what's the situation like for women across the globe compared to Australia?
I'd say probably the proportions differ a little bit. So globally, about 51% of the positive population are women.
Okay.
Whereas in Australia, we're facing sort of around about a bit over the 10% mark. Similarities are that in the Asia Pacific region, women account for around 32% of new diagnoses. And we do certainly see quite a representation of women from places like Southeast Asia within our Australian population.
Okay.
There's also obviously quite significant prevalence of HIV in sub-Saharan Africa, and we do see women from those regions within Australia who are also presenting.
Oh, wow.
We have quite a small average, I suppose, in comparison to the rest of Asia Pacific. And there's really two differences, I suppose, to reflect on in that sense. And that's probably our really privileged position as a high-income country with a very responsive health system. We've been quite proactive in our response. So especially in considering things like the establishment of needle and syringe programs very, very early on in the epidemic and taking a harm minimisation or prevention approach. And also the really hard work of many community groups and activists very early in the course of HIV in Australia. Of course, you could also argue that as a high-income country with a good health system, we could be doing even more to prevent women acquiring HIV. 10% might seem like a small group, but it's actually quite a large proportion when you think about a total population.
Oh, gosh. It's fascinating stuff. A lot to talk about, but we have to take a very short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
This is Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9, and we're continuing our chat with Alison, Juliet, and Heather from Positive Women. Now, one of the reasons why we were talking about why women tend to be overlooked in the HIV response is that, all things considered, they're generally regarded as low risk. Any one of you, perhaps Heather, do we have you still there?
Yes.
Ah, excellent. but what sort of impact does this assessment that women are low risk have on women and their visibility in the HIV response? How about you take that one, Heather?
Yes, I would like for you to repeat.
No problem.
I kind of missed the last bit.
No, we're just wondering, why is it when we classify women as low risk in the HIV response, so if we say gay men are high risk or injection drug users are high risk, but women are low risk, what effect does that have on women and how we talk about them in terms of HIV?
Well, I would just say it means that often women are ignored as a sector that actually needs, you know, attention as far as living with HIV is concerned, and which means that not a lot of resources is not put towards, you know, finding more about the experiences of women living with HIV, what their needs are. It's actually about undermining the experience. If we are often seen as low risk, and that means less attention is paid towards women, which in itself means being not included in a lot of research, and the experience is not valid.
Okay, that's unfortunate to hear. I guess broadening that and many ways, if we're saying women are low risk, how does that experience differ from that of men or gay men in particular when it comes to HIV? You know, women tend to be marginalized, but what else? What other issues do we face?
Well, I think on a really practical level, if you're talking about prevention, it creates a real lack of a testing culture for women. So a lot of women may not seek out HIV testing because they have a perception that they're not at risk of HIV. And well, what we know is that anyone who is having condomless sex is at risk of HIV. Anyone who is an injecting drug user is at risk of HIV. Anyone who, you know, is at risk of HIV needs to be tested. And that message really doesn't sink in and doesn't get through to women in particular. I think potentially, I mean, anecdotally, what we see when we speak to a lot of our members is also a sense which can be quite alarming, is that this message doesn't necessarily get through to healthcare providers either. They don't necessarily discuss this risk with women. They also may perceive some women as not being at high risk, and they don't actually bring up some of the key elements to maintaining their sexual and reproductive health, which is ensuring that they're tested. So,
yeah, so they're making the assumption, oh, it's a woman, this person isn't ever going to be at risk of HIV.
Absolutely.
Why would we bother instead of doing it? Is it, how would you say, Heather, a risk or a behavioural assessment? Is that the right terminology for it?
Yeah.
Sorry?
I would say behavioural assessment is good. Sorry, Heather, would you agree with that?
Yes, I was just going to jump in and say that and also support what Juliet just said, that by saying that if they're often always viewed as low risk, it means that when they get that diagnosis, it means it adds another layer of stigma or discrimination, because it's not often viewed as a norm. So I was just supporting what Juliet was just saying about the women experience. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
just another question. Are there any particular groups or perhaps subgroups of women who may be more susceptible to HIV or who face greater challenges when living with the virus?
Yes. by prevalent regions are particularly vulnerable to HIV and they carry a higher risk burden than women from, you know, from the general population, I mean, Australian population, because their needs are often unique and they intersect with a lot of complex cultural and religious and, you know, different belief systems. Aboriginal women and Torres Strait Islander women as well as heterosexual sex to remain their most common route of transmission. Whereas when you look at Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander women, the notifications in the male Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander population have doubled. So which means the women in that subgroup are at higher risk. So culturally diverse women experience additional stigma as well and discrimination related to their cultural background, and then being in a foreign country, they face, you know, even greater challenges with their diagnosis.
So, is it... I'm just wondering, because one of the things I've often heard is that because women from culled backgrounds and from Aboriginal backgrounds don't necessarily think they're at high risk, or there's a lot of stigma or difficulty in associating with community, that they're not getting tested as early or as frequently, and that when they are testing, the treatment they receive is substandard. Is that an accurate impression?
I would say yes and no. I'd probably say lean towards yes more, because research shows that a lot of women in the heterosexual community are diagnosed late. Which is related to the fact that in those communities, in the culturally diverse communities or Aboriginal or whatever, or generally in the heterosexual community, there isn't that testing culture we find in other populations. And women that have migrated from overseas often see, they don't often see themselves as being at risk of contracting HIV in Australia, because it's a different country. They view Australia as a country that's free from HIV, because it's never talked about, especially in the heterosexual community. So it's something that's there but not there.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, yeah. I think it does. I guess it's kind of getting into one of the next questions, is the question of gender inequality that I know it plays a big role in many cultural and linguistically diverse communities. But more generally speaking, what effect does that have on the experience of women living with HIV?
Well, as we know, that gender inequality is a huge issue in our society generally, and you're right, John. It can be more of an issue for women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. But it is an issue in Australia for all women. And what that does, it adds yet another layer of disadvantage to women living with HIV, because they have to deal with the interacting with a gendered social system in the same way that all women do. And then on top of that, they have difficulty transacting safe sexual health for themselves. They have difficulty sometimes in accessing services. Okay. So the gender inequity really is just another layer of difficulty in for these women.
That's something I'm curious about. It's a difficult concept for me, so I can imagine there are other people who aren't understanding it quite as well. So when you say a gendered social system, what sort of things are you talking about by that?
So I guess we walk around a world that has not really been set up to privilege women.
Yeah.
So things like the fact that women tend to go into more lowly paid occupations. Women tend to bear the unnegotiated burden of carer responsibilities in our society. Women tend to be paid less. A lot of, you know, people often talk about things like merit. So, we appoint people on merit, but merit is a subjective concept that's been designed not to privilege women. So women, you know, miss out on opportunities maybe because they've got, you know, care responsibilities or that kind of thing. So that's what we mean by structural inequalities.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a bit more sense than you hear these terms, and I think we get a little lost sometimes in the terminology.
It's hard. Yeah. It's hard. It's really hard to understand because we've all lived with it all of our lives, and we don't know the world any other way. And it's only now that there's really being a light shone on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that even women are becoming conscious of these structural inequalities that just exist in our world.
One of the things that seems to stem from that is,
wanted to ask a question. Is family violence an issue for women living with HIV? I mean, it is an issue for women, but is it an issue for women with HIV? And why? Why is it an issue in the positive community?
So the evidence seems to point to the fact that there's a kind of a reciprocal relationship between family violence and HIV, so that there's an association, so that if you have HIV, you're more at risk of family violence, and if you're a victim of family violence, you're more at risk of contracting HIV. So we know that one in three women in Australia will at some time or other be subjected to some kind of gender-based violence. And the figures in women living with HIV, we think, are higher, although it's not always easy for us to get evidence in this context. But that's what we believe to be the case.
Well, when you have that issue of family violence, that's obviously a fraught issue. It brings to mind something about disclosure and how does one disclose in that sort of environment or outside of it if it's occurring. Juliet, what would you say are some of the unique challenges that women face when it comes to disclosure?
Well, I think really gender inequality is kind of the underlying factor for many of the sort of topics that we've touched on already. Mm. It's a limitation on choice and power and an ability to enact your own rights as a human being, and that's based around something that is very difficult to change, which is your gender. And so, in terms of disclosure for women, there's a lot more stigma that's layered, I suppose. So okay. Layered in terms of expectations around their identity as a woman, and then an additional layer of expectation and, I suppose, problematic ideas around HIV and responsibility. So either this really problematic dynamic of a woman being perceived as either a victim or somehow responsible for her circumstance when she's diagnosed with HIV. And as we know, HIV is not a death sentence. It's a manageable condition. And yet it's something that, particularly for women, is used to label and really ostracise and limit their rights and their choices.
Yeah. God, it's a difficult issue to tackle, and I think one that we don't have nearly enough time to talk about. But we'll take a very quick break, and then I think we can delve a little bit more into disclosure and some of the issues around that.
Joy 94.9.
This is Well, 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 and we're still talking with Alison, Juliet, and Heather about women living with HIV. We were talking about, before we went to break, disclosure and some of the issues. And Juliet, there was a lot in your answer,
but it's
yeah, it's such an important thing that I can't actually read my chicken scratch that I wrote here on the note, but I think one of the things that it gets to is stigma and the issue of stigma and disclosure and how they kind of play into each other. Can either one of you kind of explain what that is and how it works?
Okay, well, I suppose what we were touching on earlier around agency and actually being able to disclose is one really huge precondition for women, and not just for women, for many people living positive. It's those conditions that set up whether or not it's safe or unsafe to disclose. And for women in particular, there's no real single answer as to why. I wish I could give you a really fantastic one-line answer as to why it's so difficult, particularly for women. Obviously, one element is gender discrimination, so ideas around restrictive gender roles, which we've talked about. Another element is a real risk of being isolated from your community. Now, as a woman, either from a culturally diverse background or a woman who's very involved in her community and perhaps has care responsibilities, that's a really isolating prospect, and that's something that's quite terrifying, and it's something that definitely gives pause for thought in terms of wanting to disclose your status.
Another
element that I think is really important that we've touched on already is a threat of family violence. So that's a really realistic proposition for many women in Australia, and it certainly has an impact on whether someone is safe to disclose their status and whether or not that's going to be something that they feel may endanger them in terms of their experience of violence. And then there's also simply the fact that some people don't feel comfortable sharing their personal health information, which I think is perfectly fair. Okay.
Indeed. Yep.
Now, this is going to be a bit of a pivot, but it's something that seems to be resulting from all this discussion of gender inequality and family violence and all this, is that in addition to your massive schedule events on World AIDS Day, you were both able to attend the launch of Victoria's Gender Equality Strategy. Now, I imagine some of these issues are touched on in that, but can you kind of go into more depth about what issues were discussed in there?
Sure, and thankfully they were. So I guess some of the really key issues that the Gender Equality Strategy pointed out, which we've touched on again tonight, is that gender inequality really touches on every element of a woman's life course. So it's present when a young woman is receiving, you know, a different amount of pocket money in the home as a child. Mm-hmm. It's different in terms of educational attainment and involvement in sport. It's different in terms of equal participation in the community, in the workforce, or also in positions of leadership and representation. And these are really crucial issues that we need to tackle, but we can't tackle them without looking at sort of those structural enablers. And part of that is definitely stigma. And some of that for women with HIV absolutely touches on HIV stigma, but the rest of it is really tied into this problematic idea that there's a particular way that women need to behave and act and be seen, and that really restricts their ability to kind of act in every part of their lives.
So that's actually acknowledged within the strategy.
Yeah,
that's cool.
It's a strategy it's been developed over the last year or so by the Victorian government under the leadership of the Premier himself. It came out of the Royal Commission into Family Violence, and it's a real commitment at the highest level to ensuring that gender equality permeates every element of our society right from the top down. So looking at imposing a sort of a gender or viewing policy development and development of new legislation all through a gendered lens.
Okay.
And it is really exciting. It's exciting for women in Victoria. It's exciting for women in Australia. It's the first state in Australia to release a strategy of this kind, and it's quite innovative, even in global terms. So, from the point of view of women living with HIV, we're really optimistic that because the Victorian government has committed to this gender equality strategy, that will now influence the Victorian government's HIV strategy, which is soon to be released. And we're really optimistic that the gender equality strategy will impact on the HIV strategy as well.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Heather, I know you have to go soon, but I wanted to ask you, when it comes to women with HIV, living with HIV, that is, how are the contents of this strategy going to impact them, and how will they benefit women with HIV?
I think it would position, like in summary, I would say it would position HIV within the broader context of gender equality and women's health and well-being. And this means that the experiences of women and men living with HIV would be given equal weight and that they deserve, and the unique needs of women will be identified.
Yeah.
And this would actually allow service providers to better respond to the needs of women and implement a more tailored response to the unique needs of women living with HIV.
Okay.
It also be an important step into reducing the impact of gender inequality at a systemic level. And I also think that it will support HIV clinical trials that include a representative sample of women, which is, you know, this relates back to what I've just mentioned about research, and it would also allow the analysis data that is currently collected but not currently sex and gender aggregated, or to this data for it to be available at a wider, to the wider sector at a broader level. So I just think if women are made a priority, it will change a lot as far as the experience of women living with HIV is concerned, and it will probably tell us more about what their needs are.
That's excellent. Yeah. I really hope that happens, because obviously we talk about all these issues that need to be addressed a little better. I think one thing that's interesting, we talk about a gender equality strategy, but we know we have a national 8th HIV strategy coming up.
Yeah.
Is this something that when women, if women are listed as a priority population, this, do we see anything changing?
I think Heather's summed it up really nicely. I mean, this, the same goes, I suppose. If we're going to institute an understanding that women need to be made a priority at a state level, I think that it makes a whole lot of sense that that's happening at a Commonwealth level, and that will enable even greater coordination between the states in terms of our response. And that's really, really been key to our success previously, is that coordination from the Commonwealth level down. If we can have that happening, and we can have that including gender equality, that's a really exciting prospect for women living with HIV, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what are some of the issues that you'd like to see if there is an 8th National HIV, well, when there's an 8th National HIV strategy, what are some of the women-specific issues that you'd like to see addressed in there that you will be advocating for?
In particular, I think the first step has to be ensuring that we have good data. So we have good evidence to base a lot of our interventions and our programs on. So the disaggregation of data by gender does occur, but it's not necessarily publicly available. It's not necessarily widely disseminated in the community. So it's really difficult for organisations like ours, who obviously we're quite small, we're not able to conduct all the wonderful surveillance that we might like. It really helps us to understand and get a better understanding of the picture in terms of a national approach to women, but also then we can drill down and say, well, what's different about Victoria? Because we do get quite fantastic surveillance data in Victoria. What's different in Victoria, and what do we know we might need to be adjusting if we're looking to be serving and best serving members from other states?
God, so much to unpack, and I keep running out of time to talk about it. And we do have to take a short break, but we'll be right back with the Women of Positive Women. You're listening to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9.
Joy, joy, joy. Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with Juliet and Alison about women living with HIV. Now, a couple of weeks ago on the show, we had the lovely Max Niggle, who I know you know from Living Positive Victoria, lovely man, and he was on talking about ageing and HIV, but specifically he was talking about men living with HIV and ageing. What kind of challenges are there for women, or for women to face, as gradually the population of women living with HIV age?
Okay, well, ageing is a really interesting area, I suppose, in relation to HIV, particularly for women. So it's really different for everyone. But for women living with HIV, there is some evidence to suggest that some of the inflammation caused by the virus, and I won't go into too much detail, I promise, I won't waffle on as I have been, may impact some of the natural progressions of ageing. So for women in particular, that includes things like a potentially slightly earlier onset of menopause or perimenopause.
Really?
Not to get too technical there, they are both different. And what we do see anecdotally is that some women may perceive that they are having an earlier onset of menopause when in fact they're going through perimenopause. Menopause is when menses stops completely. Perimenopause is in that period leading up to that time. So hasn't stopped completely. And in fact, people's fertility is still relatively stable during that perimenopausal period. So people who are worried about perhaps being told that they're going through perimenopause and they're worried about having children can still have children in that time. So knowing the difference is very important, but we can help you with that. Other elements regarding aging that are particularly important are the rise of sort of non-communicable diseases in people who are populations who are growing older. So things like an increased risk of heart disease. So exercise, low sugar, salts and fats, and reducing our alcohol, really important for that. An slightly increased risk of lung cancer. And a really important thing to note in that is to quit smoking. And there are some fantastic programs out there in the community-based organisations to assist you with that. In terms of an increased risk of osteoporosis, so that's a loss of bone density, which is particularly felt by women. exercise, so regular exercise, getting some sunlight and ingesting some really high calcium foods like dairy, salmon and broccoli are really great moves. But most importantly is probably isolation and depression. So as we're aging, perhaps we're engaging a little bit less with our community or with our peers. And so it's a really great time to be thinking about connecting in with an organisation like Positive Women or Living Positive Victoria, if Max is listening, just to connect in and get that peer support or get some counselling to discuss some of those sort of natural progressions and some of the natural slowing down that comes with aging. But of course, you don't have to slow down completely. Aging is a bit of a mindset as well.
Yeah.
And I guess importantly for women, older women are also a little bit more likely to struggle with housing costs in older age. So again, that great big term gender equality rears its head again, and we need to sort of look at what we can do to future-proof the financial security and housing needs of women. And then, of course, we need to look at our healthcare sector and think, well, what are we doing to teach our aged care workers and our healthcare professionals who are dealing with an ageing population of positive people about HIV so that they can create a really safe space for their clients?
Yeah, well, I do recall a few handsome gentlemen maybe developing a resource with Living Positive Victoria called the Positive Caring Handbook that provides just such information.
Wonderful. They sound delightful.
I'm sure they're wonderful. I'm sure they are. Very handsome, both of them. Another bit of a pivot, because we're trying to get so many topics in here, but a big thing that you guys recently did as an organization that some people found unusual, but I want you to explain it, is you released some position statements on PrEP for women. Women have not been included in the conversation about PrEP, or if they have, it's been very little, or it's only been trans women, and even then, there usually is an afterthought. So why PrEP? Why did Pause Women release these position statements?
It was predominantly driven by exactly what you just said, that the PrEP conversation began, you know, I guess 1 to 2 years ago now. We sort of became aware of this talk of PrEP and what is it and who does it apply to. And there was a bit of a vacuum in terms of information for women both living with HIV plus women not living with HIV.
Yeah, yeah.
So we decided to look at what the issues might be and to provide a couple of position statements so that anyone who wants to know about PrEP and how it applies for women can go to our website, and we have two statements there, one for all women and one for women living with HIV. And,
okay.
It can provide a bit of clarity about who might benefit from PrEP and just general information to really fill that kind of vacuum that we saw in that area.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah, to unpack that as well, because a few people listening might say, women living with HIV, well, why would they want to know about PrEP? Because it's a preventative tool. But again, for us, it's that idea that, you know, empowerment through choice, it can only happen if you have clear information. And so for women living with HIV who have partners who are in serodiscordant relationships, they might be thinking, well, PrEP sounds like something that would be great for me. And they might have seen, you know, the Double Happiness campaign and thought, well, I'm using treatment as prevention, and PrEP might be a really fantastic partner to that. But I don't know that much about it and its efficacy. And I'd like to know, in terms of my partner perhaps using PrEP. And also for women who are looking, and perhaps other forms of prevention don't necessarily suit them, or they'd rather know everything before they make a decision.
Yeah.
They really needed that information to sort of understand exactly, you know, the dosage and the period of time that might be required, because are sort of differences in particular studies in terms of those particulars for women. I've said particular a lot there.
It's fine.
It's very particular.
One of those types of issues.
Is there anything else about your work that you'd like to share with the listener? And then as a lead on maybe from that, what's the one thing you'd like the listener to learn about women and HIV? Whoa.
Well, I think we've sort of gone full circle here.
Yep.
It's really, I guess, understanding that women do experience HIV in Australia, and, you know, obviously globally it's a huge issue for women. We would like people to know that we're there. We're there as a source of information. They can visit our website, www.positivewomen.org.au. There's information on our website. They can contact the office. We have Heather, our peer support worker, and we have volunteers and plenty of people who can talk to people, provide information. So I guess just knowing that we're there and that we provide a really safe and confidential service if women out there are concerned about their confidentiality and their safety, we are really mindful of that. So I guess that's a really important message that we'd like to send out.
Considering you are the only organization in Australia dedicated to helping positive women, I think
specifically,
it's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, other organizations like we've talked about, Living Positive Victoria, who are a partner organization of ours and really big supporter of ours, but we're specifically there for women. So,
well, and so much of what you've talked about is visibility of women in the epidemic. To have that dedicated organization is, I think, remarkably important.
And also, while we're thanking our partners, we also do need to thank the Victorian AIDS Council, who are also a partner of ours. But we're both really, really amazing partners, both organisations, and VAC providing us with a space at the moment out of which we provide peer support if people feel more comfortable to go there than to come to our offices in Southbank. So, we couldn't do what we do without our partners. So,
I think that's true of all of our organisations. Yeah.
Have you ever had a secret? I mean, not just any secret, a big secret, the kind that hurts to keep in? I've never said this out loud before, but I'll try my best. I mean, you don't really know me, so I guess I can tell you. Okay, here we go. I'm gay.
You're accepted. The Facebook app that allows LGBTI youth to come out anonymously. Visit youreaccepted.com.au. Another community message supported by Joy 94.9.
This is, of course, Well, here on Joy 94.9, and you're with John and Tex.
Hello.
And we still have our lovely guests in the studio, Alison and Juliet from Positive Women. Now, we are very rapidly hurtling towards the end of the show, but we'd like to say we are immensely grateful to have you both in the studio. Earlier we had Heather on the phone. It was great to have the three of you so that we could get three different views on Positive Women. But if our listener wants to stay in touch or perhaps get in touch with Positive Women, is there a phone call? You've given us the website, but let's have it again. How do people get in contact?
Okay, so that website again, positivewomen.org.au. The number is 03-9863-8747, or they can email info@positivewomen.org.au.
That is fantastic, and thank you for joining us again, and thank you to our dearest listeners for joining us for another week on Well, and thank you also to our podcaster, David.
The gorgeous
right?
David,
yes. I remembered his name. I'm so excited. Thanks again. Have a lovely evening and excellent week, and we will see you next Monday.
Cheerio. Nighty night.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.